And just like that, we are 7 weeks past Thanksgiving. And only 14 weeks until Passover. It's fast. The reason I bring up Thanksgiving is that gratitude is truly a powerful thing, as we heard in Mr. Tootle's message that weekend, Thanksgiving. Now, prior to that, I had read a Discern article online from 2017 called How to Raise Contented Kids. Really helpful article, highly recommend it. So it made the point that gratitude is the number one antidote to discontent. Gratitude is the number one antidote to discontent. I've been thinking about the idea of contentment, being satisfied, the total opposite of coveting. Being content, it ties into happiness, how we avoid coveting, so it's a pretty big deal. Now, it's a rather broad topic, so to focus a little bit, we've selected a few specific lessons related to contentment that hopefully encourage us to avoid the pitfalls of discontent, of coveting, of greed, of dissatisfaction, help us find contentment in all of our pursuits. Now, strategies, whether it's gratitude, whether it's serving more or giving more or avoiding lusts of the world. So we'll cover specific ways that contentment can be created. Specific situations where we either find it, find contentment, or we'll be discontent. This world is always trying to sell us something. So do we let that covetousness drive our lives, or are we content enough to never let that tempt us? Do we compare our status or wealth with others, or are we content? And most importantly, are we content with God's choices in our lives? It's kind of a roadmap. The title of this message is To Be or Not to Be Content. Title is To Be or Not to Be Content. So we'll cover three specific areas today, three main points where contentment is truly key in our lives. Three main points. First point, content in our labors. Content in our labors. Second point, content with what we have. Content with what we have. And then thirdly, content with God's will. Content with God's will. That's the structure of this message. And as we go through these, we'll highlight strategies for how to do it. Gratitude, serving, avoiding coveting, being content. So let's get right into it with point one, content in our labors. Content in our labors. The one thing we all have in common is that we all have work to do in this life. It can be our work to provide food and shelter for our families. It can be our work to raise our children. It can be our work to serve in God's church. And there are two ways to work, basically. Have you ever noticed a person who grumbled and complained in the work they were doing? And it almost didn't matter if it was going well or going badly. They were not content. And then, alternatively, while it's more rare and incredibly difficult, even for those with God's Spirit, there's the person who is content, even when things are not going to plan, even when they're dealing with things that are worthy of grumbling and complaining, they resist that urge to do it. So there are two ways to work, contently and discontently. And why is this important? What's the big deal if we are grumbling and complaining in our work? On the surface, we may not think it matters at our jobs, but if we allow ourselves to do that at work, it will work its way into our family and into the church. It goes without saying, a grumbling and complaining person is very negative. Huge negative impacts on family members, on church members, let alone that person grumbling and complaining is just not happy. It's not a happy person. So not only does it steal the happiness from that person, it robs family members. It robs church members of happiness. It's amazing how big an impact this seemingly small thing can have. And it's not just about, you know, maintaining a positive attitude for our family and for our church. This is also a huge way to witness for God to people. Let's go to Philippians 2 for our first scripture. If you'd like to follow along, we'll go to Philippians 2 and read verses 14 and 15. We'll read Philippians 2 and verses 14 and 15. Philippians 2, verse 14 says, "Do all things without complaining or grumbling," in other translation, "and disputing, that you may become blameless and harmless, children of God without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world." And we know that scripture very well, a very tall order. That's why it's important. It says, in other words, do all things, all labors, contently. Complaining or grumbling and arguing is often the sign of being discontent. And to avoid doing that is part of becoming blameless, becoming harmless. Part of our conversion to become a child of God is part of how we're shining our lights in a crooked and perverse world we live in. So contentment in our work is a big deal. It's not that there aren't things worthy of dispute, of argument. But this isn't meant to address that. It's intended to address discontent and the robbing of joy that comes from working without contentment. And I can say from personal experience, where I have failed to be content at work, it does have a major impact on others. My boss, my family, it robs happiness for people involved. Now, as we mentioned earlier, for strategies, the number one antidote to discontent is gratitude. So there are those strategies then to remain content in our labors, being grateful for that work that we do have, for opportunities that that work provides us, for the ability to enjoy the fruit of that labor and have the joy of serving other people, and that we don't have toxic atmospheres, which is the case for most of us. But at the same time, contentment is not accepting a bad situation. Because we can still be content and looking for how to fix things at the same time. It can be a little confusing because discontent with a bad work situation, that's a very valid reason to change. But there's a pitfall where even if we're in a good work situation, we could be discontent, not seeing the blessings or the positives that a gratitude might reveal to us. It's not that we have to accept a bad situation, but we're to be content in an objective way with what God's given us. Now, as with the three ways that we're going to cover today, the big pitfalls are not being thankful for our labors, or comparing our labors to others, or being sold a bill of goods by the world about our labors. It's just not good enough. If we aren't grateful for the work we do have, that grumbling and complaining personality could develop in us. At church or in our families, if we aren't content in those labors that we often volunteer for, or if we're not grateful for the serving and the opportunities that we have, or if we start comparing ourselves to others, or if someone outside the world sells us that we should be in a better position, that may start that grumbling and complaining. And if we are discontent, our kids will definitely see it and could model that way if they see it in us. Now, here's an example of one of the biggest ways that this manifests itself, and that is our work-life balance and what place we put money versus time. We can ask ourselves the question, is more money always better? Is advancement always better? Even at the cost of some things? So I'd like to read you a story. It's a folk tale. There's many different versions out there, but here's this version of it. There was once a businessman sitting by the beach in a village. He saw a fisherman rowing a small boat towards shore, having caught several fish. Businessman was impressed and asked the fisherman, "How long does it take you to catch all that fish?" The fisherman replied, "Oh, just a short while." The businessman was astonished. "Then why don't you stay longer at sea and catch even more?" "This is enough to feed my whole family," the fisherman said. And the businessman offered a suggestion. "You have a gold mine here. You should spend more time at sea and try to catch as many fish as possible. And when you have enough, you could buy a bigger boat and catch more fish. Soon you'd be able to afford several boats, set up your own company, your own production plant for canned food and distribution." The fisherman asks, "And then what?" The businessman laughs heartily. "After that, you can live like a king in your own house. When the time is right, you can go public, sell all your shares on the market, and you will be rich." Fisherman asks, "And then what?" The businessman says, "After that, you can retire. You can move to a house, some remote village, live an easygoing life." The fisherman was puzzled. "Isn't that what I'm doing now?" And it's just a folk tale, of course. It's made up, contrived. But it makes a point. Is increase always better? Sometimes the amount of money we make or want to make or the desire for more money can be a major driving force behind discontent in our labors. While providing for our families is critical, there's a level of discontent that can come in if we allow love of money or love of increase to drive our life. Love of money can make us work more, which is not necessarily bad, but the more we increase, perhaps the more we want to work, and the more we make, the less that increase will satisfy us at times. If we grow to love the money and the increase and the abundance just for the richness of it and the satisfaction surrounding increasing, the less and less satisfied we'll be with that abundance the more we may work. It could be a cycle. Let's go to Ecclesiastes 5 and read verses 10 through 12. Let's go to Ecclesiastes 5 and read verses 10 through 12. This is not like a common pitfall that we're all dealing with, but it is sort of an extreme ditch that we have to be aware of. Ecclesiastes 5, and we'll read verses 10 through 12. Some wisdom here from Solomon, Ecclesiastes 5, verse 10. It says, "He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity." Ecclesiastes 5, verse 11. "When goods increase, they increase who eat them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep." Once we get used to and even in love with more money and abundance, the less it might satisfy. But you know, none of us are working to get rich. We work because working is our heritage. It's our lot in life to provide for ourselves so we can eat and drink. Just like that fisherman who the businessman was attempting to convince to grow his business and make fortunes for maybe the sake of making a fortune, when his business would grow, those expenses and those needed time would grow too. Labor is for the satisfaction of the soul. Not for just riches. Labor is to provide for needs. And if we're doing that, and even if we're eating a little, if we're laboring and obtaining what we need to eat, our sleep is so sweet. But the abundance of the rich here says it's all they care about, though. And that businessman can often be much more stressed in his life. But obviously there is balance in all things. We can't get away from long, diligent hours of work, and wisdom will dictate working a lot to provide for the best of our family. And that's a good thing. But this world and comparing ourselves to others, keeping up with the Joneses, it can sell us that constant increase is the only way. Just as that fisherman might compare himself to the businessman, that comparison could lead him away from his positive situation and to try to keep up, to pursue riches like everyone else is. And the world was trying to sell him in that story. So there is a line somewhere that crosses into discontent if we love money, when we truly can be content. Again, gratitude for the gain that we do have from our labors at work, in the church, it really can help us be content. Since we're here in Ecclesiastes, let's read verses 18 through 20 now in chapter 5. Same chapter, skip down to verses 18 through 20. Ecclesiastes 5, 18 through 20. He says, "Here is what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life which God gives him, for it is his heritage." Verse 19, "As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage, to rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart." Solomon perhaps learned to enjoy the good of our labor for the labor's sake, not specifically for abundance or riches. Maybe to see that benefit of our labors was more than just money. And when we have that gift, whether it's a small or large gift, and when God has given us the power to eat of that labor, eat and drink from that labor, that is God's gift to us. Contentment means that we won't dwell unduly on the days of our life, because God is keeping us busy being content. Busy with the joy of our heart. And I know that's a tall order, but imagine the fisherman's joy in his daily life and simplicity of fishing for his family, and then imagine the rat race to build a business for just the purpose of riches and increase. Now, please understand, it is not wrong to start a business. We're talking our mindset and our goal. Because for some, God is sending that businessman's idea to the fisherman as a blessing to help provide for that family, especially if they're needing money help. But then for others, Satan and the world might be sending the businessman to the fisherman as a trap to get him to leave his contentment and compare himself to others, to be sold that the extra hours and the pursuit of riches is what will bring true contentment, even though that fisherman already had it. So again, excelling in work and increasing in work and riches is not negative by itself at all. It's whether that goal is being motivated by those right things. God gives us opportunity to have abundance. And if we work wisely and enjoy the fruit of our labor, we will be content, even with a little or what we need. So that was point one, content in our labors. Let's move to point two, which is content with what we have. Point two, content with what we have. Now, this may be closely related to the first point, but it's less about content in our work and our labor and more about content with the things we have: spouse, family, house, car, possessions, and stuff. This point can be boiled down to coveting versus contentment. Contentment's the antithesis, the opposite of coveting. And we won't turn to Hebrews 13:5, but I'll just quote it for you. It's very familiar. Hebrews 13:5 says, "Let your conduct be without covetousness, Be content with such things as you have. Hebrews 13:5. One of the biggest pitfalls of this life can be a covetousness that sneaks in related to what we have or what we don't have. Things like spouse, whether it's good times or harder times, things like possessions, like a house and cars, for those wealthy enough having a maid or not, and just plain stuff like entertainment systems, box seats at a stadium or not, fancy clothes or not. Again, not that it's wrong to desire nice physical things, but the pursuit of something could be inappropriate and ultimately coveting in our heads. And this message is not specifically about coveting, but to covet, it's fighting against contentment. Coveting isn't just the priority we put on things. It's also the desire for very specific things in our life. Because there's a good desire for good things, but there's also a wrong desire for good things. Let's turn to Luke 12 and verse 15. Luke 12 and verse 15. We're going to read this one statement by Jesus and then discuss the context. Luke 12 and if you'd like to follow along, Luke 12 and verse 15. Now he, Jesus, says to this person, Luke 12:15, and he, Jesus, said to them, take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses. Now, just before this verse, in verse 13, a person in the crowd says to Jesus, teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. For some reason, that person thought that Jesus could serve as a judge in their case, looking for an authority figure to force his brother to divide the inheritance with him. Jesus warns in verse 15, as we read, beware of covetousness, discontent. One's life does not consist in the abundance of things he possesses. Now, this person may have had a very valid reason to be included in the inheritance. Man may have had valid complaint against his brother, but Jesus takes the opportunity to teach everyone about covetousness, that life is not about what we possess. Jesus could see this man was looking at what his brother had and desired it. Now, we know the command for coveting. I'll just refer to it in Exodus 20 and verse 17. I'll just read it for us. You shall not covet your neighbor's house, your neighbor's wife, nor his male servant, nor his female servant, nor his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything that is your neighbor's. Consider this. Picture a person who is desiring his neighbor's house, his neighbor's wife, his servants. They are clearly not content with what they have. And what drives that? Comparison. As we're going to cover, there's very similar things with each of these topics. Comparison, which is a very unwise thing to do. In 2 Corinthians 10:12, it says, those who measure themselves by themselves, compare themselves among themselves, they are not wise. Jesus is the only person that we should compare to, not other humans. And it's not that it's wrong wanting nicer things. It's perfectly fine to want a nicer car or a nicer home. So there's a balance and a line between desiring to improve what our family has and coveting what others have. And it's deeply in our thoughts and our motivations. Are we wanting it for ourselves? Are we comparing? Are we lusting for their life? Let's turn to 1 Timothy 6. 1 Timothy 6. And we'll read verses 6 through 10. There's a lot in the Bible about contentment. First Timothy chapter 6, and we'll read verses 6 through 10. Paul writing to Timothy says in verse 6, now godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. And having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare, into many foolish and harmful lusts which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. Love of money is just one example. Godliness with discontent doesn't really work. But godliness with contentment is great gain. Paul's helping Timothy understand possessions are very much passing. Having just food and clothing is everything we really need to be content. It kind of goes back to point one about desiring to be rich, but the desires of this life, the possessions of this life, looking what others have and desiring it, we could fall into temptation and a trap. The idea of money, again, is just one thing that we could be discontent with, and even leading us to stray from the faith and greed. Contentment is good for the soul, for happiness, and for avoiding that trap of coveting. And also, contentment creates peace. It stops war with people, including in our own minds. I'll just refer to James 4 and verses 1 and 2. I'll just read it to you. James 4, 1 and 2 says, "Where do wars and fights come from among you? Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? You lust and do not have. You murder and covet and can't obtain. You fight and war." So James is asking the question, where do wars and battles, arguments, quarrels, fights come from? Do they not come from our desires for pleasure that war in our members? We lust for things, we covet and can't get it. How many wars in the history of man are driven by discontent, likely coveting things for self-interest? How many wars are driven by not being content with what we have? They choose to take what they want. These lusts of the world, the desire for possessions, the things that belong to others, to compare ourselves to others and be sold by the world that we need the exact same thing. Is that what we should be focused on in life? Doesn't that comparison, when we do that, when we compare, if we do compare, doesn't that fuel discontent and fuel war in the end? Doesn't it cause a war in our own mind? Let's go to 1 Peter 2 and verse 11, because it does cause a war in our own mind. 1 Peter 2 and verse 11. Peter says, "Beloved," 1 Peter 2:11, "I beg you, as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul." Those fleshly lusts which war against the soul. Sermons have used their entire time fleshing out what it means to be a sojourner and a pilgrim. We're a temporary resident, a wanderer, a nomad in this life. We have a temporary stay with purpose and intention. We're not here to get bogged down in the fleshly lusts which war against our soul. But we have a job to do. We're not of this world, but because Satan has made this world ultimately about discontent and never having enough, these fleshly and worldly lusts drive men to coveting for pleasure, for drinking, for riches, for cars, for prestige, for getting what we want, for self-interest desires. And that causes this conflict inside of us. It's pleasure, yet still discontent. And all of it is because Satan is selling us in this world what we need. And we know what's in the world, and I'll just refer to this scripture, 1 John 2 and verse 16. We know what's in the world. 1 John 2:16, all that's in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, it's not of the Father, but it's of the world. That's what we face in this world, the lust of the flesh and eyes. It's this Satan's world, and it's passing away. Teddy Roosevelt, our 26th president, he once said, comparison is the thief of joy. Isn't that the truth? So if we can abstain from those lusts, we can imagine how much godliness with contentment there could be. We could imagine that. So how do we create contentment? Being content with the things we have is very much tied to having our conduct be without covetousness. And as we've been covering, these same strategies apply to every point. Gratitude for what we have is the number one antidote to discontent. But there's other reasons we're discontent. First, as we've been discussing, we might be comparing ourselves with others. Second, our desires for things might all be self-centered or self-interest. So we can spend it just on ourselves. And third, the world and Satan want to sell everything to us in this world, whether it's good for us or not. So to combat these things, we pursue the opposite, being grateful for what we have. If we still desire things, if we're falling prey to lust, we can consider serving more, giving more, focusing our increase in outgoing ways, not in the self-satisfying ways. We can focus the reasons we want increase to be for other people and stop comparing ourselves to others too, as it steals joy. But let's talk a little bit more specifics about how to create contentment and how we can implement this in our families. And I'm going to borrow from that article from Discern in 2017, How to Raise Contented Kids, because I thought it was very helpful. Here's four specific takeaways, as we've kind of been covering already, what we can do in our own families, starting with practice gratitude. We can practice this at home and teach showing gratitude first. My daughter will often become very unhappy when she has to stop doing something she loves, whether it's running out of her favorite food or not being able to watch another show. One of the best things we can do is try to focus our child on being thankful for what they did have or what they were able to do. And it's less successful now, but earlier she was more receptive to, oh, I'm so cheerful now because I just said thank you for what I had earlier. So it completely changed her mindset. So it is helpful to focus on thanks for something when you're disappointed missing out on something. We can work gratitude into daily conversation, thankful for our house, for water, for many different things, in our prayers and at meals. We can do this especially when things are not going well, to still be thankful, and it helps mindsets focus more on what to be thankful for even when there's really bad news. The second takeaway from that article is to give and serve in unique ways. And they can be done individually or as a family, trying to use that resource to benefit others. And that can help us grow content from helping and giving others instead of becoming content with the self-satisfying things that we do. To focus less on satisfying our own wants and more time developing joy by giving to others or serving others. That can be done through community service, cards for people, helping others. Can give that perspective on how to get joy in a different way. And then, obviously, we've been talking about this comparison, but the third takeaway from this article was discouraging comparison. Because we're always going to encounter people with seemingly bigger things, better positions, more prestige. Whenever we or our kids feel discontent, we have to speak up and talk about the danger of comparison. We have to see other people doing well and do our very best to be happy for peers when we see them enjoying their blessings and accomplishments, because we should also never feel a lack our kids feel a lack because someone else is doing great things, we should never feel that, because we all have our talents, our strengths, our blessings. And so often with comparison, we compare based on only what we can see. We don't know what's underneath the surface. It's never as golden as those appearances show. So when we think so lowly of ourselves and highly of someone else, we don't really know the situation. We're just going based off appearances. So it's easy to compare and feel like we have a lack. And then the fourth takeaway from that article was limit materialistic influence. Limit materialistic influence, because this world is designed to sell us and our kids with materialism, getting things, and self-satisfaction. So many activities that kids and teens do are for just fun in this world are so tied to materialism that instead of just social interaction, choosing activities then we can do to get us outdoors that avoid materialism to try to celebrate simple joys can help. And then when our children are being sold things from the world, we can talk about how we're being sold those things, how the world's trying to sell that, to see the manipulation involved with things being sold to us, opinions being sold. Those were the four takeaways. Now, more than anything, though, if we can model contentment in the midst of all this, we can not only help our children and our families, but we can help each other in the church. Just as examples in all the other Christian living topics, we can succeed here too, showing that we can be content, even when it seems hard, and that can be a great example to others. Well, what if we feel this is just too difficult? Eve and our forefathers failed to be content, so what chance do we have in this world that's so built to have us compare ourselves, be sold by all the lusts that Satan flings at us every day? How are we supposed to do this? Well, we can model ourselves after Paul. Let's go to Philippians 4. Philippians 4, this is where we get our strength to do this. Philippians 4, and we'll read verses 11 through 13. Paul is writing the Philippians and describes his mindset here. Philippians 4, and we'll read verses 11 through 13. He says, "Not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to live abased or live humbly, and I know how to abound or live in prosperity. Everywhere and in all things I've learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." So he was able to look at his need, and he learned by living in either state that he could be content in the times he was poor and having to live humbly and in the times he was living in prosperity. He learned there was more to contentment than being in one of those categories. Now, sure, on the surface, it seems one category would be a lot easier to be content in. But we're constantly amazed at how we acclimate to our situation and find things to be discontent with, even when things are objectively going better than ever. And if that seems still too hard to do, Paul gives all the credit where it is due. He can do all things through Jesus Christ who strengthens him. It's through the Spirit and God's mindset that we can be content in any situation. So that was the conclusion of point two about being content with what we have. So let's cover third and final point now, being content with God's will. Being content with God's will. Now, most importantly, whether we can be content or discontent with God's will and choices in our lives, that's the ultimate application of contentment. If God chose to not answer a prayer in the way we want, Or should God's will mean we lose something or go without something? Do we learn to be content or resentful? And God often blesses us so abundantly. We often have so much given to us. But when it comes to carnality, we often will focus with tunnel vision on specific items we want but don't actually need. Now, we have the examples of the thorn in Paul's flesh, God telling him his strength is sufficient. Was Paul able to be content with that? When God gives us so much, do we ever focus on the one thing we don't have, and then it just steals our contentment? Let's go to Genesis chapter 3. There's a very early example that we're going to tie into contentment of Eve in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 6. And we read this section often, but it's helpful to read this part. Genesis 3, and we'll read verse 6. So this is Eve and being deceived by Satan. Genesis 3, and we'll read verse 6. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. She also gave to her husband with her, and he ate. So here is a huge example of Adam and Eve being given everything from God, every tree in the garden. Now, clearly, Satan was very deceptive, but for some reason it wasn't enough that God gave them everything else. Eve was not content with everything else. She had to have the one thing that was pleasant to the eyes, desirable to make one wise. And this coincides with the other themes we've covered so far about being content with our possessions, and pursuit of things is often based on just the worldly lust for things. She was human, and we understand the lust of the eyes. But what if she had been more content? Gratitude for everything else is a great way to combat the lust of that one thing that we still desire, or that one thing that keeps trying to sell us. Because Satan is always selling us something, so we can be on guard for it. If only Eve had known he was selling and she could be on guard for it. Now, one thing we should make perfectly clear. In one sense, since we are supposed to mourn, we aren't content when death occurs. But we are content with God's plan. It's a challenge to be content when we have losses and debilitating pains. It would be tough to be content if we could never walk again, or if we lose someone close. Of course, we're not content in this world. We want the resurrection. We want God's kingdom. But that discontent is not what we're talking about today. Because we're not content with sin. We aren't content to witness sin constantly around us. The contentment we're discussing today in God's will and in his choices for our lives, we're talking about accepting what God decides for us. Knowing his perfect love and plan. We don't resent or know better than God. We don't grow to grumble against God or be discontent with his choice. Let's go to Isaiah 45 and verse 9. Isaiah 45 and verse 9. These things that we're talking about are, you know, the worst-case scenario that we want to stay as far away from as possible. Isaiah 45 and verse 9. Isaiah 45, 9 says this, "Woe to him who strives with his maker. Let the potsherd strive with the potsherds of the earth. Shall the clay say to him who forms it, 'What are you making?' Or shall your handiwork say, 'He has no hands?'" Now, I'd like to read this from New Living Translation. It makes it much more easy to grasp. Isaiah 45:9 from New Living. It says, "What sorrow awaits those who argue with their creator? Does a clay pot argue with its maker? Does the clay pot dispute with the one who shapes it, saying, 'Stop, you're doing it wrong'? Does the pot exclaim, 'How clumsy can you be?'" God's mind is so far above our minds, and the world's definition of love is increasingly different from God's definition of love. God knows what we need in the long term to be in his family. He knows why certain losses have to happen, why certain things can affect so many people. We often can't see that ourselves. So while we are discontent as far as Satan and sin in this world and missing those we've lost, we can still be content in what God is doing in our lives, what he gives us, what he chooses to withhold. Content in that we can trust God and maintain joy in our lives as a whole. Not let dissatisfaction with those choices of God's to steal our joy, to steal our conversion even, or to steal that ultimate reward by just not trusting God. It says, "Woe to those who strive with their maker. What sorrow awaits those who argue with their creator?" Do we ever tell God, "Stop, you're doing it wrong"? Or, "How clumsy can you be?" That grumbling and that complaining leads to deep unhappiness. But trusting in God and being content God is in control, it's probably the most uplifting and joyful thought we could possibly have, allowing us to find contentment even in the challenging situations in this life and in the world. There are things God has specifically commanded us to go without. There are closures and satisfactions that God has told us must wait for a future time, and that he handles things on our behalf. Are we willing to give up on those desires? Are we content to trust God in his timing? Let's go to Romans 12 and verse 19. Romans 12 and verse 19. Let's read a specific example of trusting in God and his timing. Romans 12 and verse 19. This is one thing that God asks of us. One example. Romans 12 and verse 19. Here's an example of something. Are we able to be content with God's timing? Romans 12 and verse 19 says this: "Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. For it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay,' says the Lord." This is one specific example of something we should be content with. God specifically asks us, avoid taking revenge in this life. Give up anger and wrath when we're offended or hurt deeply, even if justice dictates that grumbling and complaining is valid. Even when justice requires others to be punished or killed even, can we accept this command of God? Can we be content with this command? It's an example of things God requires of us. That contentment myth has to be practiced. We don't just grumblingly agree to this. We contently agree to this. Or are we not content with his timing? We could be discontent waiting for God when those offenders live life like nothing has happened. That could be a pitfall to growing discontent with God and his will and his choices in our lives. But being patient to the end and trusting God is key to all of that. And it leads to incredible happiness, as we've covered earlier. It can also be one of the greatest witnesses for God and his way of life. People can see us giving place to wrath, see how different it is from this perverse and wicked generation. That loss or severe offense will either manipulate or will either emulate what Jesus would do, or we'd follow the same pattern as everyone else in the world. It's definitely not easy to be content, and we're not content with sin or corruption, but it's contentment that God's mercy is giving us exactly what we need to become part of his family. That those offending and sinning in this life, we know they're blinded by Satan and sorrow, so we can be merciful and content to be patient with them, realizing our contentment is also that witness to them. So that is the end of point number three, being content with God's will. So now that we're 7 weeks past Thanksgiving and 14 weeks from Passover, hopefully we've rehearsed being more thankful in our lives. Remember how gratitude is the number one antidote to discontent. It's so tied specifically to happiness, being satisfied, avoiding coveting. It really deserves time to be mulled around in our heads. As we've covered today, contentment in our labors and what we have, to work for God's gift of enjoying the fruit of our labors, not for the world's idea related to riches and increase, not to keep up with others by comparison, but to sleep sweetly even with a little. And we've covered the many strategies. We do this by being grateful, by serving others, giving to others, not comparing ourselves to others. We can keep our guard up to the materialistic and selling ways of the world that provoke that covetousness in us. If we avoid focusing on self, that helps us to be content in every endeavor. And lastly, it was contentment with God's will, his choices in our lives. We can be content with the overall plan of God, where we are in it, and that the world tomorrow is coming. We can be content. God is always choosing things for us that get us to the kingdom. They're always driven by perfect love and hope. Discontent with God can often be an underlying reason we're discontent with other physical things. And that just steals our joy and it steals our hope. So instead, we can live contently and still always pursue perfection. To be or not to be content.